Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along to the Sydney Institute tonight at 41 Phillip Street, where Senator Richard Di Natale makes a welcome first appearance at the Institute. His predecessors, Bob Brown and Christine Milne, have been here in past times, but the Senator makes his first appearance. He's well known to all of you, but I'll introduce him briefly. Senator Di Natale has been a Senator of Victoria since 2011 and the Leader of the Greens since 2015. His background was in medicine, and he's now obviously in politics. And the topic for tonight is the new economy is more than just a slogan. Senator Di Natale, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Jared, for the introduction. I really appreciate it. Thank you to all of you for coming along. And let me acknowledge the elders, past and present, of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation as the traditional owners of this wonderful harbour on which we meet. Let me begin with a statement that you won't hear from a politician during this election campaign. The fortune of Australia's economy are largely hitched to the whims of the global marketplace, and we politicians have very limited control over Australia's economic future. Now, you'll hear commitments from the old parties about how they'll achieve a surplus, they'll lay out their timetable for achieving it, how their policy prescriptions are the only ones that will help us get there. But there's one certainty, that they're very unlikely to be proven correct. You only need to look at the commitments made by the Labor and Liberal Party, who promised surpluses in the lead-up to recent election campaigns, and those commitments have been proven to be false. And I think that what you'll soon see is that the promises that we hear over the coming weeks around a budget surplus and the timetable in which it will be achieved will also be proven to be false. And why is it? Well, 30 years ago or so, we made a decision collectively that we'd link our economy to the global marketplace through a range of economic reforms. We know what they are. We reduced tariffs, we floated the dollar, we stopped propping up industries that would employ people in particular regions. It was a period of significant economic reform, and we reaped many benefits from those changes. But we also lost a great deal of control over our economic destiny. The old command and control model of the economy was transformed into a complex network of transactions characterised by uncertainty, unpredictability, and unintended consequences. It's a world where tipping points abound and where very small interventions in the market can have profound and far-reaching effects. Governments are no longer in the driver's seat. Rather, our role is to ensure that the airbag's able to cushion the impact on passengers when a crash occurs. The theory behind opening up to global competition and scaling back protections is that it keeps us sharp, we can seize emerging opportunities, it keeps us on our toes in a competitive global marketplace. And we're told that prosperity comes from doing those things that we're good at and leaving behind those things that other nations do better. The theory, though, falls down when dominant global traders preach liberalisation for everyone else while protecting politically sensitive industries, agriculture being a good example. It also ignores that for many nations, cost advantages come from reducing labour standards and environmental protection. Now, I don't mean to sound too pessimistic. Governments are not powerless. We might not control the economy in the way that we once did, but we certainly influence it. Governments have got a very important role in addressing market failure, and there's no greater example of market failure than dangerous global warming. The entire point, and this is again, if you accept the science and somebody who doesn't see that there's another reasonable alternative, the whole point of putting a price on greenhouse pollution is to internalise the externality of carbon pollution and to point us towards our inevitable economic future with minimal economic disruption. The laws that we pass in the Parliament also have a huge impact on how local and international investors see Australia. These laws put in place those structures that encourage economic activities in some areas and dissuade economic activity and investment in others. You only need to look at the tens of millions of dollars of international investment that left our shores when both the Labor and Liberal Party slashed the renewable energy target to know that what we do here in Australia matters a great deal to the rest of the world. And while those of us who sit in the Parliament aren't in control of the economy in the way that we once were, we are the only ones that can ensure that our economy works for all of us and not just for those with wealth. Never before has the quip that it takes money to make money been truer. Given that our wealth grows at 6-8% and wages grow at about 2-4%, rising inequality in Australia is not a freak occurrence. It is built into the system and it compounds over time. And it's our role as legislators, the only people who can actively mediate between wealth, opportunity, distribution and, of course, sustainability. It's not just a decision that affects us, it affects all of us in this room. It's also a decision that affects those generations that follow. We decide which generation will wear the impacts of our decisions on global warming, housing affordability, habitat loss, the accumulation of wealth and the depletion of resources. One of the most important ways that parliaments are able to shepherd the direction of our economy is through the tax system. So the profit motive seeks opportunity, and just as water flows to the lowest point, investment will flow towards locations where tax incentives are greatest. Irrespective of the impacts on our economic resilience, on our environment, on issues of intergenerational equity, that is what profits seek to do. So where in the Australian economy do we shelter tax, thereby encouraging capital to flow? Where are those areas? Well, there's three main areas that are the subject of a fierce national debate at the moment. The housing market, superannuation, and the mining sector. They're the three big areas that where we see capital flowing as a result of significant tax advantages. The revenue measures that the Greens have proposed during this election campaign, part of our fully costed policy platform, addresses each of these three sectors, and we do it for a range of complementary reasons. Firstly, they're measures that will end these significant tax concessions and raise revenue, and in doing so, we reduce the structural deficit that we accept is a challenge for all of us, but we also enable the community to receive those services that we know are so critical, healthcare and education, for example, that we also know are most efficient when they're funded and provided collectively. Secondly, the reason for addressing those areas is that it addresses the distorting impact of concessional tax arrangements so that capital flows into more productive areas of the economy. We don't want lazy investment, we want productive investment. And finally, because each of those three areas contribute to growing income inequality in Australia. And the IMF have said many reasons for tackling the issue of income inequality, but the IMF have acknowledged it's a significant drag on our future growth. Now let's look at housing, for example, as the first of those areas, the main lending activity of our banks. ABS data shows that in 2014-15, Australians invested a staggering $283 billion into existing housing. It's not lending to build the businesses of the future, powered by clean energy. It's simply our banks borrowing from overseas wholesale markets, pumping up household debt that this year's reached the highest levels in the world, paying prices driven up by tax breaks in order to buy assets that Australia already owns. In fact, for every $9 of private debt here in Australia, we're generating $1 of economic growth. Compared with, say, the US, which at $3, or Asia at $2, gets a dollar back in terms of economic growth. The willingness here in Australia to lock up debt in unproductive property investment, it's not a sustainable path for longer-term prosperity. We need to be attracting long-term patient capital in a range of areas that will help build our nation's future. In addition to this inefficient allocation of capital, massive intergenerational inequalities are being entrenched. Younger generations are deprived now of the dream of owning their own home, and that's so true in a city like Sydney, and they're mad as hell about it. I do say with some pride that we have been at the forefront of the economic debate on each of these issues. We were the first party out of the blocks to make negative gearing a national policy reform issue. We want to abolish negative gearing for all future purchases and to restore the system that Keating created, where real adjusted capital gains are not taxed more favourably than tax on income. Again, lots of reasons for it, but capital gains are overwhelmingly enjoyed by the highest income earners, so keeping the discount on capital gains undermines the progressivity of our tax system and is adding to our growing income inequality. Of course, removing the discount would do nothing to deter foreign investment because foreign investors can't access capital gains tax currently. And I am pleased that the Labor Party's adopted at least part of our policy. We don't think negative gearing should exist for future purchases. They believe that it should continue to exist for new homes, and they want to discount the capital gains tax rate. We think you might as well go back to Keating levels and abolish the discount altogether. The next area is superannuation, which again is another hot topic, and again we're out of the blocks very early. We've been talking about the huge tax breaks that are enjoyed overwhelmingly by people on high incomes who might otherwise invest their money in other more productive areas of the economy. Just think about it. Someone on $249,000 a year gets double the tax benefit of someone on $60,000, while a mother working part-time earning under $18,000 gets no benefit whatsoever for saving for their retirement. Of course, super is invested, but it's the very wealthy who have the incentive to divert their earnings into super. We led the debate on this issue, on ending those wasteful superannuation tax breaks. And in just we know that in just a few short years, they are going to cost the government more in tax breaks than it pays out in age pensions, which itself is the single largest expenditure item of the Australian government. So those tax breaks are going to be worth more than the pension. Our plan is to make super contributions more progressive, like our income tax system. Both Labor and the government's changes don't address the core structural inequity of the super system in which contributions are currently taxed at a flat rate. Let me get to the last of those areas I spoke about. At a time when our export base is as concentrated as it was during the Korean War boom, it's absurd that we continue to provide huge tax concessions for the mining industry. It's time we ended the extravagant accelerated depreciation concessions for both mining infrastructure and exploration, which, if you look at the case of gas, will mean the public doesn't collect a cent from the gas boom until it's over. Just as we helped super and negative gearing become national issues, I'm confident that soon we will see a national debate about removing the tax-free subsidised fuel for mining operations. That day's not too far away. We don't think it's fair or just that we pay 40 cents a litre in fuel excise at the bowser, while companies like BHP, Rio Tinto and Gina Rinehart get it tax-free. Clamping down on these three crucial areas of housing, raising $14 billion, superannuation, raising $11 billion, and mining subsidies, raising over $20 billion over the forward estimates, will repair our budget, it will address the issue of income inequality, and it will get money moving away from speculative, lazy, tax-sheltered locations into the productive areas of the economy that will set us up for the 21st century. So the big question is, and I think everybody's asking this question because whether it be super or negative gearing, at least there's an acknowledgement that these tax havens need to be addressed. The big question is, if we turn the tax tap off to reduce money flowing to these unproductive areas, where are the productive areas of our economy? Where will our future prosperity be derived? Well, when you ask the Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens, when you ask him the question, where will the growth come from? He said that much of it will come from new things, often things of which we are dimly aware. The rise of the sharing economy is a good example. No one expected middlemen to be so quickly cut out of the deal when it came to things like the trading post, hotel chains, or the taxi license plate owners. Been some big changes in what's known as the sharing economy. Look at what the CSIRO is doing, for example. Right now, the CSIRO is piloting projects to create hydrogen through electrolysis from solar thermal power. Gas and liquid fossil fuels could one day soon be replaced with pollution-free hydrogen in the use of energy, chemical feedstocks, and indeed vehicle fuels. And Australia has the competitive advantages of sunlight, of space, of ingenuity, but we haven't yet shown the political foresight to prepare for it. Imagine Australia as a clean energy superpower, exporting bottled sunlight to power the vehicles and industries of Europe and Asia. Now, it's not an economic future that will happen overnight, but it won't happen at all if our leaders don't invest in these long-run prospects that might take a decade or two to pay off. It certainly won't happen while CSIRO funding has dropped to a level to barely keep the lights on and while R&D funding has been gutted. We hear a lot about innovation from this Prime Minister, but when you scratch beneath the rhetorical surface, what you actually see is that we've got publicly funded research cut to the lowest levels ever recorded. The government, and it's now with the support of the Labor Party, has banked $690 million by reducing R&D tax credits for the private sector. Any innovation in Australia's regional areas will be hindered by substandard broadband infrastructure. Remarkable that we're still having this debate in the 21st century. Transformative innovation cannot happen under these policy settings. It just won't happen. The Greens policy platform recognises that government does have a role to play in supporting innovation, that we can't just rely on the invisible hand of the market, which too often focuses on capturing economic rents at the expense of creating value. We need an enabling state to create an entrepreneurial nation. That's why our budget invests $7 billion into research and development. We'd invest more over time by requiring the Future Fund to establish a new division where 3% of its assets are holdings, would be in R&D activities and innovative projects. Driving the next wave of productivity comes from our commitment to $20 billion in a lifetime of learning funding program that starts with childhood education through the needs-based funding under the Gonski model with support for people with disabilities, into stronger TAFE and university-based funding. You only need to look at the success of the Australian Renewable Energy Agency and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, those institutions that were negotiated by the Greens and the Independents as part of the carbon price package, to understand how those institutions can shape the direction of this country. They have both been an enormous success, and much of the technology derived through those institutions is being exported right around the world. And yet, we have the Australian Renewable Energy Agency facing a $1 billion funding cut in grant funding after the election under both the Labor and Liberal policies. So what they're going to do now is only offer debt finance and no longer invest in seed funding for potential clean tech breakthroughs. And that will have huge knock-on effects for decades if those changes go ahead. One of our other major comparative global strengths is agriculture. And I met with a young Nuffield scholar in the Liverpool Plains a few weeks ago who'd been touring the world, seeing how farmers in other countries ply their trade in very tough conditions. And he told me just how well Australian farmers are able to do with significant restrictions, particularly when you look at the issue of access to water. Now, for those people who believe that regulation only strangles business, I point them towards the tight regulatory framework for the water market and how it's encouraged our farmers to innovate and to innovate well. We need to do the same to better manage agricultural chemical runoff from the Great Barrier Reef catchments if we're to save the reef. And I'm pleased that there have been some recent commitments during this election campaign. Sadly, too little. One hopes it's not too late. Innovation will break out as carbon prices and regulatory instruments provoke our broader economy to perform more efficiently than it does today, with less pollution and less waste. It's a very conservative notion, that. A small farm in Port Augusta on the fringe of the desert offers a fantastic example of Australia's innovative agricultural ability. The Clean Energy Finance Corporation, partnered with Sundrop Farms, are using salt water and clean energy to grow tomatoes in greenhouses. They desalinate the water to produce higher yields, all from solar energy. It's remarkable. I mean, we're growing produce now in the desert. And just think about the implications of that for a moment. We've got Sundrop who are keen to take their technologies into the Middle East. We might be on the cusp of a revolution in farming on land previously thought by some as worthless. And Australia, through our institutions, will have helped make that happen. But recent trends show that further gains in living standards can't be delivered by productivity gains alone. We've witnessed a worrying trend in recent years where productivity gains are rising while wages are not. The last year of the National Counts, released just a fortnight ago, paint a picture of Australians working harder, working more productively, but getting paid less for it. And it does put a lie to this notion that it's all about growing the pie, not how it's carved up. A rising tide lifts all boats is easy to believe when you're one of the few enjoying the view from a luxury yacht. For 25 straight years, our economy has been getting bigger. As the gap between income groups grows, slowly but surely. Technology-driven productivity gains, as beneficial as they are, will only help workers if those benefits are shared. If those with capital no longer need labour to earn profits, the bargaining power of workers disappears. The technological revolution we're witnessing has the potential to snap the taut ropes that have pulled in opposite directions and held our political system and our society together since the Industrial Revolution. The Committee for Economic Development of Australia last year released modelling that 40% of the Australian workforce faces the high probability of being replaced by automated technologies in the next 15 years. And it does scare me that there are people there, young people, who are studying at TAFE or doing a uni degree right now, who are racking up a pile of debt for a job that might actually not exist when they need it. I mean, sure, it's exciting. Driverless vehicles coupled with the shift of freight from road to emission-free electrified rail to reduce emissions and ease congestion is a very exciting proposition. But contemplate the effects on truck drivers and couriers of those workforces potentially disappearing, and disappearing rapidly. But it's not just those jobs. There are other white-collar professional jobs. I look at my profession of medicine, my former profession. The rise of computer programs that can diagnose through complex algorithms complex health problems, that alert one to complex drug interactions, that can now look at prescribing software integrated with diagnostic software. It has the potential, again, to transform the medical workplace. But our profession, the profession that I trained in, very soon will no longer be recognisable. Now, technology replacing jobs, it's been a process that's been playing out for centuries. After all, barely any of us are farmers these days, when just a few centuries ago, many of us would have been. The cyclical process is that we find better ways to do what are considered physically intensive or mundane jobs and replace them with jobs to service our increased wealth. Whether it be travel agents or financial planners or health insurers, these are the new jobs that will be created. But the big challenge for us as a nation is that those individuals who are affected can't just transfer from one job to a different one. This is going to require a lot of planning. If you're a displaced motor technician, you don't just become a solar specialist overnight. But we've seen places like Geelong and the Adelaide car parts manufacturer turned solar bracket company IXL. It can be done with some planning and some foresight. What's a little different this time to what we've seen in past years is the rapid pace of change. And that, coupled with the lack of planning from governments to provide that airbag, that cushioning of the impacts so that we minimise the negative implications of this transition, that's what's missing at the moment. We look at one issue, which is the structural decline of the coal industry. And we have been watching that, but also recognising that we need to have a pathway for people within those industries that are affected, which is why we came up with our plan Renew Australia, which has as part of it a clean energy transition fund that will support coal-dependent communities to adapt as their local economy changes, while the old parties watch this gradual but inevitable demise from a distance. It's a transition that also takes us to deeper matters of personal meaning and fulfilment and the adequacy of which of the ways in which our society measures progress. Simply because GDP is easy to measure, it's become a proxy for national progress. This in spite of Bobby Kennedy's 1968 warning that it measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. Now, the Greens' plan for a clean new economy would see GDP rise significantly. But we also say that that is not the only marker of progress. The world we leave our children means nothing in terms of GDP. I mean, perversely, recovering from climate disasters like last week's floods in Tasmania and storm surges in Sydney boosts our GDP, while volunteers, new parents and adults taking time off work to care for the elderly are either invisible to GDP or worse, a drag on growth. Contentment, mental and physical health, closing the gap with First Australians, flourishing environments that protect and nurture biodiversity, cultural expression, personal security and freedoms, kindness to our neighbours. They are some of the true measures of social progress, but these are all subordinated to measuring economic transactions. Now, that's why the Greens welcome developments like the Index of Australia's Wellbeing from groups like Lateral Economics. We also welcome the coalition of academics and public institutions working on the Australian National Development Index, because we need a new measurement of progress to remind us that simply producing, consuming and trading isn't the only measure of a civilised society. You see, the economic principles of the Greens differs from the other parties because our starting point, the meta principle if you like, is that the economy has to work for society and not the other way around. The daily column inches written about the economic skirmishes between the Labor and Liberal policies are a distraction from the entire point of a successful economy, to ensure that we have a quality of living. If any party won't miss the forest for the trees, it's us. So let me come back to where I started. One of the most dominant of distractions is the notion that achieving a budget surplus is somehow synonymous with good economic management. I mean, the federal government's been in deficit for 80 of its 115-year existence.
80 of 115 years. How could Australians enjoy such a fantastic standard of living, one of the best in the world, if a surplus symbolises everything our polity thinks it does? Howard and Costello could not have delivered a surplus without a China-driven mining boom. After all the tax cuts, superannuation giveaways, return to tax or taxing capital gains more lightly than income, the nation was in a structural deficit that was disguised by the rivers of gold flowing through it. These are some of the financial problems our parliament is now trying to reconcile. The Greens do believe that it is important to have a budget in structural surplus, where Treasury's expectations are to close the gap between spending and revenue over the course of an economic cycle. It's the sustainability of the budget position that matters, and that all depends on the context of surrounding global and domestic events. We do believe that budget deficits should be kept to a limit of, say, 3% of GDP, but it should move counter to business cycles, especially in times like we have at the moment, when the impact of monetary policy is far less potent than fiscal policy. The closely related distraction of deficits is, of course, debt. The last 20 years of political scaremongering about debt has cost this country so much in lost opportunities. Of course there's bad debt. Debt that's used to recover recurring expenditures. But there's also good debt. Debt that's used to invest in our future, like productivity boosting infrastructure that transforms our economy. This budget could have chosen to put the $4 billion of income tax cuts lost to the budget line into infrastructure. Given the current structure of the budget, we're essentially drawing down debt to pay for the tax cut that benefits the top 25% of taxpayers, which we believe is a poor economic strategy, which is why we'll oppose it. Income tax for people earning over $80,000 won't bring a fraction of the economy-wide benefits that investment in productivity-enhancing infrastructure would bring. Keeping our AAA credit rating is important. It's important to us because we see the important role of debt to invest in the future. So while we all want to keep that AAA credit rating, why is it that we don't want to use it to access the cheaper debt that will allow us to invest in productivity-boosting infrastructure? To make this task easier, and for the improvements in the transparency of government, the Greens believe that the government borrowings for productivity-enhancing capital works should be in a set of accounts that are separate to any borrowings to service recurrent spending. In this new economy that's coming, we need public and private innovation to help us ride the wave of prosperity. But there's simply no avoiding the fact that the Parliament will have an important role to play. We need the state to invest in clean public infrastructure to create new opportunities. As an Australian thinker on these issues, Mike Dowson said, capital, like technology, is largely blind to human need. Capital goes where the profit is. If there's a profit in healing minds and saving species, some of it would go there. While there's more profit in alcohol and gambling and deforestation, more of it will go there. But the fact is that most affect our destiny are not options in the supermarket. If a healthy society is something we want, we have to act collectively. There is no escaping the role of the Parliament in securing a prosperous future in all of these areas I've discussed tonight. Productive investment, ingenuity, technological change, productivity, the future labour market, and the preservation of our precious natural heritage. The Greens are a long-term party. We have a long-term vision, which is why we'll be around for a long time. As political leaders, we can either use an election campaign to scare people about budget black holes, boat arrivals, or we can reassure them by letting people know that we're thinking about their future, that we're planning for it, and that we'll make sure that whatever turbulent changes affect our country and our economy, we'll look after people and the natural world that sustains us, that we'll share in this prosperous future together. Thanks very much.
Many thanks to Senator Di Natale. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got till about the top of the hour. I ask you to keep your comments or questions brief. Just starting off where you started, you were talking about how recent governments had not been able to push, had not been able to deliver on surplus, and consequently had broken a promise to do so. But as you know, that was partly due to the production in the iron ore price, which, whilst is not bad at the moment, is certainly a lot lower than where it had been when some of those projections were made. And as you know, this would indicate that mining companies certainly do pay tax and other forms of revenue, because otherwise that money would be in the budget. Your proposal to effectively put a tax on fuel that's used off-road, where for everyone else it applies on-road, would effectively be taxing mining companies in a different way to which any other company is taxed, because companies can write off their expenses against their taxes. So what would you envisage the immediate, if what you are saying today is implemented, what would you envisage the immediate impact on one of Australia's major income earning revenue sources, which is the sale of iron ore at the current price, which is lower than it has been but higher than it once was?
Well, there are a couple of assumptions in your introductory statement, Jared. One of the issues around achieving a surplus wasn't just the collapse in the iron ore price, but something called the global financial crisis as well. Both of those things, obviously the change in commodity prices, the global financial crisis under different governments, have really proved the point that in terms of achieving a surplus, what was it? Was it John Kenneth Galbraith who said that economic forecasting was invented to make astrology look good? So I think we have to recognise that there are always going to be economic headwinds that we sail into, and that we have to be as best prepared as we can to navigate our way through those. And one of the arguments here, central to this, is having a diversified economy that allows us to ride out many of those challenges. On the specific point about the diesel fuel rebate for the mining industry, we've had long discussions with people on this, whether it constitutes a tax concession or not, I think is in part in the eye of the beholder. I know that there will be some people who argue that it's not a concession, and there are many well-versed economic views that argue that it is a tax concession. Our view is that, of course, the mining industry has played an important part in Australia's prosperity, and it will continue to play a role. But the big challenge for us is to diversify our economy, to recognise that if we are going to be less vulnerable to changes in commodity prices, that we do need to start taking advantage of some of the big opportunities that exist in the new economy. And we don't do that by cutting investment in R&D. We don't do it by cutting investment in education. We don't do it through many of the measures that this government's implemented.
Right, there's a question here. Yeah.
Do I stand up or sit down?
You can stand up.
Thank you, Senator. You're a wonderfully charming and convincing chap.
Sit down. Sit down. That's it. Thank you. Next question.
I could even believe you were responsible for us getting tomatoes out of salt water.
Not me.
But look, in the context of the coal industry, for example, I mean, we're all Greens to the extent that we're all ashamed of what we've done in an unregulated times to our rivers and our harbours and all the rest.
I think a few people in the audience just had a heart attack, but anyway, we'll go on.
We now live in a highly regulated time. Mm-hmm. Is it sensible for us to ban high-quality coal mining when it is a very leap, and I'm not nothing to do with the coal industry, but has nothing to do with, or much less to do with carbon pollution than if we cancel it when the contracts go to lower production coal and all sorts of other things. All that achieves, it seems to me, is that we will contribute more to pollution and cost Australians a lot of jobs.
Okay.
Hmm. Well, my argument is that this is an economic imperative for Australia, and that the industry is in structural decline. You've got one of the biggest... Is it the biggest company, Peabody, that's on the verge of bankruptcy? We have the coal price that's tanking. We've got... I mean, the argument that we're having now globally is not about whether coal has a future. It's just how long has it got. And we will, at some point, it's not too late, we will be at a point where we as a globe derive our energy from entirely renewable energy resources. And the economic prosperity of nations depends on which nations embrace that challenge and get in front of the curve. And we are a long way back. The simple argument is that coal does not have a long-term future. It is in structural decline. That if we want to save the reef, we can't continue to open up mines like the Adani mine, which if it was a nation would be the seventh biggest emitter in the world. And that as nations like Australia engage on this transition, we also give ourselves the opportunity to capitalise on the jobs and international investment that comes from the clean renewable energy economy. And I think they're the choices that we have to make. Let's also remember that there are big tax concessions that go to those industries, and that if those tax concessions were diverted into more productive areas, and renewable energy economy is one of those, that we have the potential to create jobs in regional communities, and much of this transformation is happening across regional communities. I visited Broken Hill recently. Massive solar farm there that transforming the community of Broken Hill. And we have the potential to amplify that. We've got all of the natural advantages that we need in this area. We've got space, we've got the renewable energy resources of sun and wind, we've got the technological expertise. So what we need to do is recognise whether we want to continue to subsidise an industry that is fuelling dangerous global warming, that will mean we lose the reef, or we start creating those jobs in the 21st century clean green economy.
There's a question here, then we go over here. Yes?
On a totally different topic, though, as long as I've been here at the Institute, nearly 30 years, I've listened to politicians from all backgrounds talk about innovation, the future, China, Asia, and we're all going to be leaping into this marvellous new future, which I'm very happy with, and I hope that all politicians will keep on saying that. But go to education. We've never spent more money on education. We've never had such poor results. And what we've also got is someone who used to be an educator. We've got a huge gap between the very brightest and the tail at the bottom. Somehow or other, the money we keep chucking at education is not having the desired effect. What's the suggestion?
Well, I think when you look at OECD levels in terms of what we spend on education, I don't think...
It's never been bigger in Australia.
Yeah, well, but that's... We've population's never been bigger in Australia either. I'll get to the question. I think that there are a few things that I'd say about it. One is to ensure that you're funding education on the basis of need. And we still live in a country where your postcode determines your educational opportunity. So we are absolutely committed to needs-based funding as a model for how we spend that education dollar. We're also committed to making sure that those kids in schools who have got learning disabilities get the support that they need. And money's not the entire answer, but it's a big part of it, a big part of it. Now, are we open to other reforms in the education sector that might deliver results? Of course we are. If there are reforms that are being proposed that allow us to be able to spend that money more efficiently, always happy to... look at interesting proposals. But to suggest that we're going to improve our educational performance by reducing the commitment... But some people are. I mean, the government's proposal is... Well, the government's proposal is that we reduce funding for that's on the basis of need, that we don't fully commit to the Gonski reform model. I don't think that's going to help the cause of improving education in this country. I think... the opposite. it's likely that we'll go backwards.
I just want a rejoinder. That presupposes that where we're spending the money is well spent. You can give someone $1 million over here and another person $1 million over there, and they can both go out and get very poor results, or one can and the other not. And I'm not saying we need to cut the money. I'm saying that we are not getting the outcomes for the spend. And so instead of talking money all the time, we ought to be talking educational standards. Mm-hmm. And we are not doing it.
Okay, we have a response, then we go over here. Yeah. No, we have a response, and then we go over here.
Again, if you've got a concrete proposal that you want me to respond to, I'm more than happy to. But, I mean, sure, okay. Improving educational standards, I certainly don't want them to go backwards. But if there's not a specific proposal, then I'm happy to take the next question. Yeah,
thank you very much, sir. Different question,
yes.
Senator. Thank you very much for your talk. And in response to this gentleman's question, who said Australia has a lot of space, that brought me to this idea there. I was floating around an idea that Australia could furnish a nuclear fuel cycle for the world. So, give uranium, which is in abundance, sell it and take back the waste, store it somewhere in Australia. That would solve problems in many
countries. Okay, so the
suggestion
is...
What is your opinion on this?
Because we're such a big country, we could be an internal fuel cycle from producing uranium to storing waste.
Yeah. It won't be a huge surprise to learn that I don't support that proposal. I mean, look, you've just got to decide whether uranium and the nuclear industry is going to be an industry that will take us forward through this century. And if you, again, look at what's happening in terms of generation, the growth is all happening within the renewable energy sector. Should Australia play a role in terms of being a key player in the nuclear fuel cycle? I don't think so. I think it's an industry that's dirty, that's dangerous, that's very expensive. And I don't see why Australia would want to play a role in that when instead what we could be doing in places like South Australia, which is where one of the proposals has been mooted, we have the opportunity to have solar thermal plants where we can increase our capacity around photovoltaic, where there's huge potential for tidal and new and emerging geothermal technologies. I think that's where the future of Australia lies, in that innovation, not in a cycle that's dirty, dangerous and expensive and really doesn't have a long-term future.
There's a question down there. Yeah.
The Greens are very supportive of allowing Indigenous groups to discriminate on the ground of race to protect their Indigenous identity. They're similarly supportive of allowing, say, groups like political parties, gay groups, women's groups, or to discriminate to protect their identity as well. Considering the Greens are supportive of allowing discrimination grounds of race, gender, sexuality, why are the Greens so hostile to religious organisations like religious schools to make decisions to protect their identity?
Again, won't come as a surprise to you that I reject the premise of the question, and I'm not sure on what basis you've made those assertions, but we think there are some things called universal values, and we think that when you look at issues like the horrific shooting that we saw yesterday, an attack on gay and lesbian people, that we as a nation need to do everything we can to stamp out homophobia, to do everything we can to recognise that there shouldn't be discrimination between people on the basis of sexuality or gender. And it's a fairly, we think that's a fundamental principle, and we're informed by that basic principle.
There's a question here.
Yes. When the original studies of carbon emissions were done, they excluded agriculture, they excluded the proliferation of carbon emissions from bushfires, from uncontrolled burnings, from the fact that we've fostered too many eucalyptus trees. They didn't consider the fact that we have one ocean in which has been dumped huge amounts of sewage and pollutants, which has affected El Nino. In fact, just stopping coal mining by itself is not going to achieve what you want to achieve. I want to know what you think about this.
Okay.
I'm not,
I'm not sure
of the contribution of sewage to El Nino. I suspect there's not a scientist around who would suggest that those two things... I'm not sure what the question was. You might want to paraphrase for me.
Well, the suggestion is that we're not concentrating enough on what's happening in the oceans as a factor in global warming. I think that's right. Okay, that'll do. We've got to move on. Yeah.
I mean, again, I'm guided by the science, and the science is very clear on this, that coal is making an enormous contribution to rising greenhouse emissions, and that the consequences of that are being felt right across the world in a number of areas. And, I mean, we can get into a discussion about our different views, but I'm guided by what the science is telling us, and the science is saying very clearly that emissions from coal are a major factor in global warming, and we have to reduce them. I think it's a fairly straightforward proposition.
We're getting reasonably close to the end. There's a question here. Yeah.
There's been almost no global warming for 19 years. That's even from the IPCC. Mm. Rajendra Pokhari even admitted that a few years ago. There's been no significant warming. So the science really isn't settled. Why should we be jumping into renewable energy targets and making Australian industry use more expensive energy, thus making us less competitive on a world economic platform?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we're going to fundamentally disagree on what the science says. And people are entitled to their opinion, but science is very clear on whether global warming's happening, whether it's real, the contribution of coal. And if our starting point is a disagreement on that, then obviously everything else that flows from there we'll disagree on. I just keep thinking that if I went and saw a doctor because I was feeling crook, and 99 out of 100 told me I needed to have some serious surgery, I wouldn't be looking for the one guy who was telling me to go and chew on some alfalfa and everything would get better.
Okay, second last question down there. Yes.
Does your proposed discrimination between capital and current government expenditure imply that all current expenditure should be met from current revenue?
Well, at the moment, we mix those two things up, don't we? Which is one of the problems, is that borrowing to fund projects like public transport projects that might have a good business case, renewable energy projects and so on, are lumped in together. What we're saying is that we should make a distinction, have a separate set of accounts, so that we can be clear about the things that we're investing in that will help boost productivity and are indeed a investment, and recurrent expenditure on services like health and so on.
Just a final question. Let's say it's past the 2nd of July and you and the Greens, either in the Senate or in the Senate and in the Reps, one or the other, are in a very influential position. And what would your, if you were talking to a government, whoever the government was, what would your key economic proposals be for something in the, say, in over the next 4 years, the sort of the budget term, what would your priorities be to a government?
Oh, well, that's a big question. I mean, you're asking me to outline what our economic platform is, and I've sort of given you a good rundown.
What would you be doing?
Well, I just say, look, people have asked me this question on a number of occasions, as you could imagine. Look at the things that we've been talking about during this election campaign, and if you look at what we've been saying around global warming, we don't think that there's a case for new coal mines. We don't think that there's a case to have a renewable energy target that is as unsatisfactory as the current one is. We think there should be science-based emission reduction targets. We clearly have a range of proposals around ending some of those unfair tax breaks, our super proposal around negative gearing, multinational tax avoidance, again, one of the things that I didn't mention, but we've been very strong on that front. And, of course, some of those big mining concessions. So, I mean, they're things that we'd have as part of any discussion. They're things we've been talking about during the election campaign. So, but in the end, it's a negotiation, and we would enter into any negotiation in good faith.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Well, as the leader of the Greens, Senator Di Natale is a very busy person, and particularly in election campaign, and we're very pleased he could make it to the Sydney Institute tonight to talk about the Greens' economic agenda. We'll love to have you back sometime after the election, whatever the election result is, but for tonight, thanks for explaining clearly what your policies are and for taking questions, and I'm pleased everyone was very courteous and we all had a good night. So thanks for coming along, and thanks to the Senator. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.